if it's a six.
If he drops his Macintosh, it means that there's a control ahead, and he'll bend down and pick it up, and we have to scatter, or rather take a side turning. I'll make that decision at the time. But you see, he will be in view of the control, and he has papers to get through the control, because he lives in his own entity. And this is how we made our way until dark. We must have walked from about 3:30 in the afternoon till, I should think, well after 1 o'clock perhaps. And we worked our way up to the mountains, and eventually, after one or two slight incidents, where there was a terrific crash, and the uncle let out a yell, and I scattered and ran away, and so did Joe. And then the boy, Sarke was his name, he came to us whispering, and he said, "It's all right, they're speaking Catalan," which of course the, and it was a man on a bike without lights, had ridden full tilt into the fire, into the old uncle. And then we set off once more, and I really gave the impression, in such wild country, that we weren't anywhere near civilization. And we finally dropped down a bank into a farm, and thankfully into a barn with hay, where we slept the night. And this was the route through. We had just the day's sleeping there, and I had a French dictionary, French-English dictionary, which I'm very lucky, because I gave it to this man's cousin, Sarke, the man who actually walked with us. And it came into great use about 48 years after. But I'll come to that. The next night, we started off over these mountains, and it was pretty rough going. By dawn the next day, I could hardly walk, but we were on the downslope into Spain. And we eventually, after another day's stop in a sort of cave, where, incidentally, we rested. And after a few hours, a woman started to climb up towards us, driving a pig. And she came past us, the door, it was a built-up door thing to this cave. She passed us and put down a pot. It was absolutely a typical chamber pot, but in it was the most marvelous meal, all wrapped up, omelettes and all sorts. So obviously this was the organized line. And at come nightfall, Sarke himself appeared again and said, "Well, I'm going back now, and I'll take some food with me." We hadn't eaten it all, because if I have to hole up for a day, I'll get hungry. So off he went. Come nightfall, yet another member of that family, and you could tell them by their looks, took us on, and took us on till about 4 a.m., until we got clear of the mountains. And then it was Joe and I on our own. And we had, it was a long walk. We finally got to Figueras. And I had a fair amount of money, Spanish money, on me. Went to the railway station when it was open, and I bought a ticket to Gerona for two. Dos billetes, por favor, señor, you see, to Verona. And eventually the train came in, and we got on the train, one foot on it, and then we were arrested straight into prison in Gerona. This was Figueras. So, and the worst part of the prison, it was a top prison. It was mainly political. And you had your hair cut off straight in the front with the clippers going over. life was tough, but Joe was very, he was from 33rd Street, New York, this Joe Manos. And if ever there was any scrapping to do, he could scrap very well indeed. We were in prison for only 7 days, but it was hard. We were sleeping 13 or so to a cell on the concrete floor. I really got very depressed. But eventually we were rescued, and to cut a long story short, we went into Barcelona. We were then sent by train to Alhama de Aragon, where I assumed the highest title I've ever had. I was officer commanding Allied Forces, Alhama de Aragon, Spain. And with a bunch of Americans with no hair on, we'd all had our hair shaven off, and an agreement had been made between the British and the Spanish. We took two of the petrol ships into Gibraltar and said no more petrol until, A, they stopped exporting so much copper to Germany, and they let the prison the chaps out who were in prison. So finally, that's how we got out. Senor Suna was the Spanish foreign minister, and he was the man behind it all. Eventually we got away into Gibraltar, and we nearly went straight on, but we got delayed there a few days, and eventually we were in Gibraltar, and we were flown to the UK in a Warwick aircraft, which had just come in. It was the big Wellington, and it was a nice aircraft. They'd adapted them to carry about 10 passengers. We left Gibraltar, and I thought everything was over, but everything seemed to go wrong from then on. We were struck by lightning over the Bay of Biscay. We smelt fire. We hacked our way through the floor into the luggage, and by the time we'd done that, nothing to see for it. No result, no fire, no anything. So what had happened was we had been struck, and it very often happens in aircraft, and unknown to us, the nose cone is held on by clips to the rest of the fuselage, and the lightning had burnt externally these clips. So having arrived at Lynham, we did a very good landing. We were still running on the runway. We were doing maybe 15 miles an hour when gravity overcame the pressure of the air on the nose, and the nose of the aircraft fell off and went under the tail wheel, turned us at 90 degrees off the runway onto the grass, where we all disembarked. And, you know, it's amazing how quickly we got out. This business in the Royal Air Force certainly doesn't apply where the captain waits the last. We're all out in a hell of a rush, but it was okay. Then a quick train to London, and I'd managed to phone my wife. Having arrived at Paddington, I was briefed to go to the Marylebone Hotel, still without any hair on my head, but I did have a fedora or Trilby hat. And I greeted my wife on platform 12, I think it was, and after that was over, she said, "Oh, I must say, I put on my best silk stockings to greet you, and I took my engagement ring off in the ladies and put it on the wash basin while I pulled my stockings up. And I forgot to pick up the ring. And I went out, just through the door, and I suddenly realized the ring. I went back in, and there was no ring there. And I said to the woman, virtually accused her of pinching it, because nobody else was there. And she had absolute black face. She just said, no, I haven't had it. You must have lost it somewhere else, and so on and so forth. And I was so mad, I went straight to the, nothing like going to the top, went to the station commander and station master's office, told him this story. He pressed the bell, his security officer, police came in, and I told him about this ring. Now, typical of security people, they say, "Oh yes, sir, I see, sir. Now may I ask for your identity?" Because here I was standing, I'd taken my hat off to go into a station commander's office, station master's office, and I had no hair on my head. I was losing all the way along the line. I hadn't even an identity card, and I'd given up my ticket, my travel warrant, you see, at the barrier. And I explained all this, but oh, what a complication, you've no idea. My dog tags I'd hidden, and because I didn't want to have these found on me at one point, you know. And it really was. However, they rang up Marylebone Hotel, and of course that's a railway hotel, but it was commandeered by our intelligence people. And they said, "Yes, we're expecting a man called Griffiths." And then it dawned on them that I was telling the truth. And so that was the end of that saga. Oh, I just wonder what else could happen. But it was August the 14th till about November the something, 20th, I think, to sort of get back. I reckon I did more walking in ours, in that squadron, than ever I did flying. It was very smooth the way it was laid on.
So you had a debriefing with SOE, did you?
Yes, the debriefing was at the Marylebone Hotel the next day, where my wife lived at Penrhyn. We went out, and then I came in and had a full debriefing. And it must be there now, the debriefing somewhere. But we never got our engagement ring back. We've never had one since.
Who debriefed you?
I'm not sure. It was, I think, a flight lieutenant. Or was it? Yes, must have been.
So it was the RAF, not SOE, who debriefed?
Yeah, oh yes, yes.
Just one final question. What was Pipette like?
The which?
Pipette. What was she like?
She was, at that time, 45... She was, I got a picture of her here, she was blondish, very energetic. I think she had the start of Parkinson's disease. At first I thought it was perhaps she was afraid, particularly, but no, I now know it wasn't. And indeed, I saw her just before she died, and she was about 82 then, and oh, what a character. In fact, she told me that after I left, and just after me there was a chap called George Miller, wrote a hell of a good book about Mubarak, and it's called Road to Resistance, because he was so taken with them, he went back and dropped in as an SOE agent and worked in Amaki. Now, Pipette said that after George Miller had gone, they got on to her, that she was passing people through, and it got rough. So she took to the Mackie, and for 2 years, her kitchen ceiling was the stars. And she was living up in the high mountains with the lads. And one of the thugs there, which was a very good chap, he was an Italian actually, but he was, I think he must have been a bit Jewish, but he married the, what I call the head girl of this bunch she had. And they've got a very fine business now, and they live at Annecy. Talk about sin, it seems to pay off. I don't know.
So you're in the Le Chambre Bleu with Yes. You were with Pepette.
When I was Pepette, yes, when I stayed there, they put me up as an honored guest, and I was so in fact, I was sick on the floor there. Until we took to the mountains, and then, of course, I was on net, this wire netting. Makes a very good bed, wire netting with something like bracken on top. And they kept this going. Even after the war, I went back, years afterwards, and my bed was still there. And it's become a sort of... Well, while you're there, I must show you. Even the Queen Mother was taken through my story, which was illustrated when she opened the June the 18th, was it this year, the new museum at the mountains at the Pont Les Morettes.